They don't feel they have what they need, and they sort of realize they should. Like, I make all this money. Why do I still feel like I can't keep up? Why do I feel like my kids don't have what everyone has? Why do I feel every time I get a raise, it's exciting for 5 minutes, and then, you know, all of a sudden, it's again not enough? Like, that sort of like rat race is very dispiriting, because it just sort of feels like, okay, if this is not enough, like, how much would I need? Like, am I ever going to feel like I have enough?
What does a Jewish psychologist see behind closed doors? Is there a growing monster in Jewish circles? Why do people purchase things they cannot afford? We asked Dr. Deborah Alper all about healthy money mindsets and unhealthy money thoughts. She is a psychologist based right here in the Five Towns, and we got into it. Join us in our brand new, never-before-seen studio right here. Welcome to the Living L'Chaim studio. Oh, and oh, by the way, we have a new jingle. If you're like me, school didn't teach you how to manage your finances. But you're in luck, because class is in session. Welcome to Kosher Money, a smarter way to wealth. Welcome to our new studio. We're here with our inaugural guest, Dr. Deborah Alper.
Thank you for having me. Honored to be here.
Originally from West Hempstead, yep. Now based in Oceanside, New York.
Yes.
Who are you and what do you do, for starters?
Okay, so I am a clinical psychologist. I work at the Yeshiva University Counseling Center, and I also have a private practice. My area of specialty is anxiety disorders, and more specifically than that, OCD.
Both of which I suffer from. But
Sure, as do many of us. So that is what I do, who I am. I'm a resident of Oceanside. I'm a wife and a mother of three children. That's who I am.
Okay, cool. So we found you. You wrote an article on our friend David Beshefkin's website, 1840. He connected us. Thank you so much, David. And what hit home for us is how money can truly impact mental health. So let's start there. What are you seeing behind closed doors as it relates to finances and money?
So we see a lot of stress. I see patients mostly from, you know, teenage to sort of the late teen, young adult years and up through adulthood. So financial stress really affects everyone. For adults, I think maybe it's a little bit more obvious in that, you know, they're trying to manage their finances, manage their family's finances, and that can be very stressful. And there's a lot of all the things you'd expect, pressure to keep up, to provide what your family needs, what your family thinks that they need. But what is interesting is that we see that the kids, the young adults, the teens pick up on it also. So they are not maybe yet responsible for, you know, their own financial situation, but they feel the stress. They feel the stress of their parents. Oftentimes they feel guilty or feel badly for their parents that they're under the stress that they're under. And what I really see sometimes that I think is interesting and sad is we see shame. This applies really to the adults too, but certainly among the young adults, there's like a shamefulness about not being able to keep up and not having what everybody else has. And with that often comes like sort of like this burden of secrecy. Like, well, you know, we'll see college students who are just really trying to keep it looking as though they have the same things as everyone else. They're doing all the same things as everyone else. And they feel this burden. Like, we know in general that when anything is shameful, it's just much harder to deal with. You know, shame is awful. And when anything needs to be kept a secret, there's an extra burden that comes with that. So it's not just the financial stress, but it's the burden of having to make it look as though you're not under financial stress.
I have about 14 follow-up questions.
Okay.
I don't know where to start. But I do feel somewhat tricked in that now I'm an adult and my parents did a good job protecting me from the world of finance, mm-hmm. in a way that I didn't feel stress. But now that I'm an adult, I feel ill-prepared for the emotions surrounding mm-hmm. money. So I feel like I'm on a hamster wheel. I feel that it occupies so much of my life. And you know, when you're a kid, someone says to you, "You don't know how good you have it. I wish I could be back in school." And I'm like, "What? School? It's the worst." And yes, you don't have the social circles that you do as an adult. But more than that, you don't have the obligation to provide. And in some ways, we have to look at it that we're lucky. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a family and all
yes.
that. But it's a tremendous burden and it never stops. It's not a question. That's just me getting free therapy.
Sorry to hear you're struggling. Yeah.
Do you see that a lot? Right? This you go from 0 to 60 miles an hour
yeah.
very quickly once you leave high school.
Yeah. So college is a very interesting time. I really like working with college students because it is an interesting and exciting time. It's very transitional. They're making a lot of decisions. They're on the cusp of a lot of things. So it's an interesting time in that, in terms of what you're discussing, like the finances, they're sort of just on the cusp. They're, most of the students that we see are still supported entirely by their parents, but they sort of know that that's ending. Like, they are starting to think about, you know, what job am I going to do? And I wonder how much that will make. And oh, interesting, I wonder what they would be able to buy me and what that won't be able to buy me. So they're sort of starting to think about it. And we see, you know, in when I answered your last question, I talked a lot about the stress that comes with not having enough. But we also see that children who are raised with enough, with affluence maybe, they worry also, because it starts to dawn on them like how much that all costs. And they start to realize, like, oh my goodness, how will I ever do that? So yeah, it definitely affects them too.
When we talk about educating children, getting them a debit card, all fine and dandy, but in some ways I think that's just outward facing, mm-hmm. right? What conversations, what should we be doing with our children to prepare them without scaring them?
I think, you know, this is going to be probably my answer to a lot of things, but it comes down to modeling and then also communicating. I think that in an effort to not worry our kids or like burden them with finances or with thoughts about money, I think sometimes we do them a disservice by not talking about it enough. And I don't mean that you need to share or should share, you know, every dollar that you spend with your kids. And certainly if you're under significant financial stress, I would probably suggest you not share that with especially younger children. But I think we can generally just sort of like be talking about money. I have said out loud, you know, when we, let's say our family has done something, gone on a vacation, you know, and I do actually, one of my kids in particular is very just attuned to money. He's very interested in like how much things cost and how much you can buy and those sorts of questions. So sometimes he'll say like, wow, wasn't that expensive or was that expensive? And the thing I have said often out loud is we like spending money on experiences. We like spending money on things we do as a family. And then on the flip, I've said, I don't think I'm going to buy whatever, you know, that pair of sneakers, something else, because that's not the things I like spending money on. And I just think that, like, it's not, you know, I don't sit them down and have a very formal conversation about our finances, but just sort of like weaving it into the discourse of your family, they learn a lot from that. And they also really learn the most from watching you. So you should let them see the way you handle money, let them get a peek into sort of emotionally, even how you feel about money. They learn a lot from that.
What are some of the common stresses you're seeing behind closed doors with money? Are people coming in and saying, I'm just not making it, I'm laden with debt? Is it deeper than that, where the stresses are more nuanced and each person has their own, you know, their own caveats within the stresses of money?
People don't typically come in, to me at least, because they're having financial stress. That's not the, you know, presenting complaint. They are stressed. They're experiencing anxiety in general. And finances are a layer on top that make everything worse. You know, so just like any other stress, that's very often a piece of it. We speak, I would say, less probably, and this is just for whatever reason, you know, what my clientele comes with. It's less about debt. And they talk more about just sort of not feeling good. Like, I earn so much money on paper, and yet, like, I just don't feel great. Maybe they are making ends meet, but they totally don't feel good about how they're doing it. They're working either way more than they want to at jobs they are not particularly interested in, but felt they had to take, or they don't feel they have what they need. And they sort of realize they should. Like, I make all this money. Why do I still feel like I can't keep up? Why do I feel like my kids don't have what everyone has? Why do I feel every time I get a raise, it's exciting for 5 minutes. And then, you know, all of a sudden it's again, not enough. Like, that sort of like rat race is very dispiriting, because it just sort of feels like, okay, if this is not enough, like, how much would I need? Like, am I ever going to feel like I have enough?
So how much of the solution there is, oh, every time you're making more money, you're spending more money? Is that contributing a large part to the stress, regardless of how much money they end up making?
Yeah, for sure. And that's, you know, we habituate to everything. Human beings habituate to, you know, all sorts of circumstances. So for good and for bad, we can get used to challenging things and manage them. But we also get used to the good stuff. So, you know, the house that seemed, I mean, I remember when we moved into our first house, we were quite young and had one child. And I looked around and thought, oh my gosh, this house is enormous. Like, I will never need more space. That's so nice. We're so lucky. And then obviously, eventually, we needed more space and we didn't feel quite so lucky anymore. You know, we just get, for part of it is because, you know, people, their families grow and they really do need more space. But part of it is that we just get used to what we have. And we see that with everything. You know, the new car is not new, you know, pretty soon. And technology, for sure, the minute you get it, it's literally outdated. And in general, stuff like the excitement of things wears off. And then if you are looking for that, like, reinforcement, that, you know, buzz of I got a new thing, well, the thing you just got no longer provides that very quickly. So then you need the next and the next and the next. And the cumulative effect of that, like, if we're all doing that, if we're all buying more and bigger and better constantly, is that on a communal level, like, it just keeps raising the standard. So what was a fancy party, you know, 10 years ago is, like, totally not today. And what was a big house when I was growing up is, like, very regular now. We keep raising the level for ourselves.
When I got married, before the wedding, my in-laws said, hey, we can do the wedding in this hall. It's not as nice, but we'll give you the money of the difference between this hall and a much nicer hall. And I'm like, I don't want the money. How could I get married in a hall that most of my friends did not? Right. And 10, 15 years later, I think to myself, no, that hall wasn't so bad. It's 3 to 4 hours, but I probably would still make that decision because, God forbid, I get married in a hall. So let's talk about that communal effect.
Well, if you don't mind, I'll just say one thing about that first. And that one thing that I think you're speaking to also is how nice it is to have a diversity of people around you and a diversity of experiences that you see. Because if not everyone you knew got married in the fancier hall, if you had some friends who got married in the fancy hall and some friends who got married in the less fancy hall and a few friends who got married in, like, a really, really even fancier hall, you might have felt more able to pick something different. You know, when everybody seems to be doing one thing, it's very hard not to do that thing because that seems like that's the standard, like that's a wedding. Something that doesn't look like that is not a wedding. If we surround ourselves with a diversity of experiences and people that take a diverse approach to finances, it just gives us a lot more room.
How do you do that, though? Because when you're entrenched in a community, everyone sort of moves as a pack, right? It could be a subtle move, but you wear that suit, you drive that car. And yeah, there is some diverse range, mm-hmm. but that range is so narrow.
Right.
So it sounds good, but theoretically, what are you telling these people practically to do, right? That communal effect is so, so strong, and it takes real strength to counter it.
So I think even just to be aware that there are other things out there is helpful. You know, we live where we live, it's true, and we send our kids to school where we do. And even, like, when I think of the diversity of experiences, like you said, it's really quite narrow. But the more we can get a peek into what other people live like, you know, New York is not the only place in the world. I'm not saying you have to move elsewhere, but it's nice to remind ourselves how people live elsewhere, even within, you know, where we live. Like, there really is. So this is what I think is very interesting. There actually is diversity, right? I mean, if you look at, you know, look at the five towns, there's tremendous wealth and there's really quite a bit of poverty. So there actually is that diversity. So the fact that it looks like there isn't, something's wrong. It actually doesn't make sense. We should be seeing a broader range. So, you know, why is that? Partly, I think people don't talk about it, you know, like the, you know, people show the successes. They don't, you know, no one talks about their debt and nobody, you know, we drive the nice car. We leave the, you know, yuckier one maybe parked at home most of the time. So part of it is that we're not talking about the true diversity in our experiences. And then the other thing is on us, that we gravitate towards the exciting things. So, you know, we don't notice the house on the block that's very small. We just, like, walk right past it. But when someone's building a larger one, like, that's what we look at.
We'll be right back. But in the 236 years that Kol HaChabad has been serving Israel's neediest, they have never, ever seen a Passover like this. There are more widows and orphans in Israel right now than ever. There are more people with significantly decreased income, if at all. And there are more families whose fathers and husbands are serving in the Israeli army right now. There are more people relying on a public seder to feel less alone. There are more elderly people and survivors who need help and meals delivered to their doorstep. And there are more food and funds that need to be distributed all across Israel. And that's why, if you have the ability to help, please help. Visit kolchabad.org/koshermoney. Links in the show notes. Give what you can. If you're listening to this after Pesach, Kollel Chabad still needs your help feeding and tending to the neediest in Israel. We're talking tens of thousands of people. And if we don't help them, who will? So click the link. You can continue listening as we go through this conversation, and you can donate. You can make an annual donation. You can make a monthly donation. You can make a one-time donation, and no amount is too small for the great Kollel Chabad. And now back to this week's episode. I was with a few guys. I was with one friend, and he was with two friends that I didn't know. And I sat down and I turned to them. I said, how much does everyone make? You know, like that was my opening question. So let's speak about taboos, right? There are some things that have come a long way. Mental health. I don't know if 20, 30 years ago, people were as open of saying, yeah, I have anxiety. When it comes to money, I think that's still bottled up. No one really wants to talk about it. We associate a lot of our self-worth with our net worth. Do you see that, A, as a problem, and B, if it is a problem, what would you recommend? Should people be more vocal? And if they are vocal, you don't want to make someone feel bad. You know, there is still a lot of identity tied up in all of that, for good or bad.
I happen to be a private person, so I understand the instinct to not share. I don't tell people what I make. I would not expect the average person to tell their friends, you know, exactly how much they earn. But I will say that, like, secrecy is a problem only in that it often hurts us. When we feel that something needs to be kept secret, what we're telling ourselves is, this is shameful. This is problematic. There's a reason I can't share it, right? That's the whole thing, like you mentioned, about mental health. Getting rid of the stigma about mental health also helps more people come forward and admit when they need help. And it also reduces the shame felt by those who need help. Like, when we're open about things, it reduces stigma and it reduces shame. So in that sense, it would be good for us to be more willing to talk about it. Yeah, I'm actually totally don't know, you know, how I'm going to pay for my kids' college. Or, yeah, that's really stressful. We would love a bigger house, but we just totally can't afford it. Interestingly, I think people have no problem talking about how yeshiva is way too expensive. Somehow, like, that's become okay and, like, totally not taboo. Even, you know, to say, like, oh, yeah, I'm on scholarship. I imagine that at one point that was taboo. I don't really think it's quite as taboo anymore. So stuff shifts. The other side that I was thinking of when you said this is that we are not ashamed to share on the other end. No one is, or most people, are not ashamed for people to see how much money they make, right? Like, meaning to buy a fancier thing or build a fancier house or make an extravagant wedding. No one thinks, ooh, but that'll be so uncomfortable. Everybody will realize that I'm wealthy, right? So I kind of wish it was at least in both directions. Like, if you don't want to share when you're struggling, maybe you shouldn't be quite as excited to share when you're successful. It's problematic that all we see are people's successes, because that's the stuff that, you know, obviously everybody shows off.
Let's talk about shame. Everyone feels it in some regard, but no one wants to be open about it. Question one, is there something healthy to shame? Does it come from a good place?
Shame is not great. No, I'm going to say there's basically nothing healthy about shame. Shame is not productive. Feeling badly about certain things, there is definitely a place for that. And sometimes there are things that we should feel badly about, and that should motivate us to change them. It makes it impossible for us to move forward. Like, shame really keeps you down. Shame makes you feel like there's nothing I could do. This is so embarrassing. I am worthless. It really makes it impossible to change. Feeling like I don't like this thing about myself, or I don't like this thing that I'm doing, that's great, because that should motivate you to do something different.
What if the shame is coming from an action that is not productive? So if someone is not working perhaps as hard as they could, right? They're only working 4 hours a day instead of eight, and they're feeling shameful about that. Isn't that in some ways a good thing, because it propels you to want to do better? I guess the shame that I was leading on was shame from an action in which they can't control, right? They're trying their best. Mm-hmm. They're only making this amount of money, and they feel some level of shame. What about something that, you know, you feel bad about within your control, but it allows you to, you know, work harder at something?
So that's great. Like, that's, you know, that's productive. That pushes us forward. The thing, shame, it's a maybe like a nuanced distinction, but shame usually comes with a lot of secrecy. I am so mortified about this that I would be so upset if anyone knew it. I don't want anyone to know this about me. I don't even want to admit this thing about me. That's not productive. If then I can't move forward. If I, you know, shame usually comes with, I'm even pretending to myself this is not a problem. So then there's nowhere to move forward from that. Acknowledging that, you know, I only work 4 hours a day and probably life would be better if I worked, you know, 6 to 8. That can be productive. Now I can make a decision. Do I want to do it or not?
What do you think's propelling people to spend more than they should. If you can't afford something, don't buy it. And I'm not speaking from a perch. I think a lot of people suffer from that, but where's it coming from?
I mean, I think we all probably suffer from that to some degree, right? The larger question is, why do we do anything that we know is not good for us, right? Like, you know, why do I go back for, you know, I don't know, the extra dessert if I know that, like, tomorrow I'm not going to feel good? Why do I, you know, anything? Why do I don't know, speed? I know I risk getting a ticket. Why do we do anything that we know we shouldn't, but is tempting, right? So it's tempting. And what I think that a lot of it comes down to is that, like, very quick reinforcement that we get, like that short-term gain. I want something, I buy it, I feel great. If I don't buy it, I don't feel great right now. I will hopefully feel great later when I still, you know, have the money in my bank account and I can afford my lifestyle. That'll feel really good. But in the moment, buying it feels better. So it's hard to do that. You know, it's like it's the same as the brownie. You know, it feels great to eat it now. Tomorrow I'll have a stomachache, or, you know, later I'll regret this. But in the moment, you want it. I also think that seeing other people have something, and we see them as just like us. They live in the same neighborhood as I do. They send their kids to the same schools as I do. If they have that, like, I really should be able to have that also. And we sort of, like, make ourselves things that we're entitled to things that we're not, because just, you know, no one is. You can do it or you can't do it, but no one is entitled to, you know, a fancier car.
A good commercial idea I just thought of, and anyone can take this, is you see people walking, let's say, with a new stroller, and there's a tag on the side. It says, like, financed with debt, or, you know, like... Yeah. People see the end result, but they don't see the means in which people got there, right?
For
like
sure.
Given to them by in-laws,
right?
So everyone thinks, oh, everyone else is making it. And the biggest question I get as the host of Kosher Money, how are people making it? People have no clue how the other person's making it, but in their mind, everyone's making it clean and green, and there is no debt in their mind. They are completely financing everything with liquid cash.
Right.
They don't have credit cards piling up. Let's talk about that, because when you see someone else having something, what's a healthy way of thinking about it? Is it simply not thinking further about it and just moving on?
I think there's a natural instinct. We see somebody else have something that looks attractive to us. We want it. And I want to say that with all of these things, there's always like the positive side of things. And then there's where, you know, it has negative effects. So that like social comparison can be good for us. It's good to look, you know, next to you and see, huh, the guy next to me is working a little bit harder, doing a little bit better. Maybe I should be working a little bit harder too. Like that propels you forward. You know, when you're a student and, you know, you see the kids around you are scoring a little higher on their tests, like, oh, maybe I should work a little harder. Maybe I could do that too. You know, like there's that someone learning more than me. Maybe I want to strive to be able to do as much as they do. So that part of it is productive. Where it gets negative is when it's so much that now it's holding me back. So that's where the social comparison starts to have negative effects on us. I think it's a very natural instinct to see what someone else has and think, oh, I wish I had that. Or why don't I have that? Or, you know, how can I get that? That's a natural instinct. I think that that's when our wiser minds can come in, and it's our job as adults to talk to ourselves and say, wait a minute, why don't I have that? Should I have that? Do I want that badly enough to do what I, you know, would need to do to get it? Am I the same as him? Why would I think that I should have the exact same things as him? We don't have the exact same things in any other areas of our lives, right? Like we're two different people. Why would I think that just because he has it, I need to also? And like we can have that very grown-up conversation with ourselves, but I think it's reasonable to expect that that's just not our first instinct.
Communal gatherings, weddings, bar mitzvahs, there's a large price tag. Almost in the non-Jewish world, it's, are you saving up for college? In the Jewish world, it's, are you saving up for the wedding, right?
Yeah.
Weddings can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars if you're not careful, if you are careful. Has the problem gotten worse over the years, or it's just inflation? You know, it's my generation just being exposed to it for the first time. Has it always been a communal related issue?
I'm not in the wedding making scene yet, so I don't know if I'm wholly equipped to answer that. I think everything has become heightened over time. I think that probably like the amount we spend on clothing is more now than it was. And I don't just mean because of inflation. I'm saying, you know, it's more now than it was 10 years ago. I think our Shabbos meals are fancier than they were. Like you don't see as many people driving the beat up minivan. Somehow it seems now like everybody has a nice car. Like I think that sort of everything has gotten heightened. So I don't know that the weddings are different. I think the weddings get picked on a lot as problematic. And the thing that I keep going back to with all of these things is that we should feel the freedom to make the wedding we want to make. If you want to drive the beat up minivan, you should feel okay. Drive the beat up minivan. If you want to have a smaller wedding, you know, and that goes back to, but as you said before, it's very hard when everybody's having, I don't even know what a normal wedding size is now, 500 plus people, whatever. When everybody's doing that, it's very hard not to do that.
Bar mitzvah is probably easier. It's just you and your family.
Yeah.
When a wedding, you're bringing another family into it. So you dang better be on the same page or you're going to have friction.
For sure. But even with the bar mitzvahs, because then bar mitzvahs are hard because it's with your kid, you know, like your kid went to all these other parties. How do you going to explain to your kid that his party is going to be smaller? I think that's hard. I, again, just anecdotally, my own family, I do have a child that is around just post the bar mitzvah age. And it was very interesting to me. I expected to be like, you know, party after party after party after party. It really wasn't actually. In his class, there was really a range in what people did. A few people had the standard, you know, 4-hour big fancy party, but a lot of people did a lot of different things, which I think is great. I don't know really where that's coming from. My guess is that parties have gotten so expensive that maybe even some people who could afford to do it said, like, this is silly. And people have started for looking for other options, which I think is great.
My son's school, they have, you can only have the party in school.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone's on the same page. Granted, you know, some have more entertainment than others, but I kind of like that if it is an actual issue in which some parties are over the top, you don't have that stress of, oh, I got to make a party like that. And that's a good point. The beat up minivan, you really don't see that, right? When we were growing up, going into someone's car or whatnot, and, you know, there were pins coming out of the backseat cushions, like that was normal. Now leasing a car is just, you know, if you don't lease, then you're in the 1%, the bad 1%. Right. There was a video with Jeff Bezos when he was worth $9-10 billion, and he's driving a Honda Accord from 10 years prior. And the interviewer asked him, said, why are you driving this? You can afford to buy Honda, the company. And he said, this is a perfectly good car. Right.
So in the spirit of that idea, when you were talking before about, I think it's a nice idea, like you said, your son's school, you know, you're only allowed to make parties in the school. I wish that people would self-regulate in that way. You know, I wish that, you know, the school didn't have to come in and say to us, okay, guys, let's all be reasonable together. We're all going to be reasonable, right? We're all going to have the party in the school. I would prefer that people on their own made that decision, but maybe in absence of people doing it, maybe it makes sense that the school comes in. I would love more people to have like the Jeff Bezos, you know, philosophy, which sounds funny, of, you know, it's good enough, why would I replace it? But that's certainly not the attitude of most.
It works when there's a structured environment with a school, right?
Mm-hmm.
When the rabbis come out and say, this is the rule for the community, that tends to not last. You know, the people, the adults, don't theoretically have to listen. So that's where it sort of breaks through, right? If they say you need to make a wedding that costs this much, it might work with some people that adhere to it, but it doesn't work. We found that over time.
No, it doesn't work. And I think it rubs people the wrong way. And I understand it because I think, you know, Americans are individualistic and we don't really like being told what to do. And we feel like, don't tell me what you know, wedding to make, which I understand. I do get it. And that's where, like I said, I would love it if we kind of like self-regulated in that way.
A short break to tell you that spring is my favorite season. Well, fall is up there too, but the spring, it's not cold and it's not hot. It's the Goldilocks of seasons without all the pumpkin spice narishkeit, which is where Twillery comes in. Hands down, my favorite Twillery product is the one I'm wearing. It's the long sleeve polo. They also have short sleeves polos. They're so soft. I legit sometimes use them as pajamas. So if you're in the market for some new comfortable polo shirts, I highly recommend checking out Twillery.com/koshermoney. If you're not in the market for some new comfortable polo shirts, do not visit Twillery.com/koshermoney. It's as simple as that. And our first customer promo code is still live. So use code CHAI, C-H-A-I. It will give you $18 off your first purchase of $139 or more. And if I continue talking, I will repeat myself. And I ain't about that life. Twillery.com/koshermoney. Links in the show notes. Now back to this week's episode. So what are healthier ways to look at our own self-worth, right? We're very tied up in, you know, maybe it's an American way of thinking of things, but how much money I make is how valuable I am. And I'm super guilty of this. Mm-hmm. I feel better about myself in months in which I'm not just making it, but I have some extra money. If things are struggling, that's a reflection on me. How do I work through that? How do I channel myself to actively think that my self-worth has nothing to do with the digits I see in my Chase bank account?
Yeah, so it's hard. And again, I'm going to say the good side of that is that caring a lot about what you earn and what you produce pushes you probably to earn and produce more, which is not a bad thing. Like, that's great to be able to, you know, support your family and have money left over at the end of the month. So that's the good side of it. But what I think is interesting is if you were to ask people, you know, at the end of your life, you know, in 120 years, what are the things you're going to be most proud of? What are the things that are going to bring you fulfillment? I don't think most people would say, you know, money, clothes, cars, right? Like, we really know the answer to that question. We know that it's going to be meaningful relationships, family time, contributing to my community in meaningful ways, being learned, being more spiritual. Like, we really know the answer, but those are less tangible and it's very easy to get caught up. You see, you know, the dollar amount in your bank account. That's like a very tangible physical reminder. And the other stuff is much harder to measure, but I think really we know. And, you know, again, that's like sort of that like wiser mind. We can remind ourselves.
What compelled you to write an article now versus 5 years ago? Are things bubbling in ways that you're like, hey, I can't stay silent on the subject?
So I'm going to be very honest about this. This article has been brewing in my head for a very long time. I don't know if it's 5 years, but a very long time, like in pieces. I was very hesitant to write it or to say anything like that for a very long time. And then someone from 1840 emailed me and said, would you write something for us? And I was like, yeah, I have this thing. It's like almost written. I just can't bring myself to finish writing it. And I'll tell you, the thing that stopped me for a very long time, and even I hesitate a little bit about it now, is I really don't want it to sound like I'm telling anybody what to do or what to spend their money on. I don't want to demonize big weddings. You know, I made bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs, and God willing, I'll make weddings too. And I go on vacations. I'm not looking to look at what anyone else does and says they shouldn't spend their money where they do. And that was my concern, because that's really, I'm not looking to demonize money at all. Money, you know, is great. I like money. Money can do wonderful things. So I hope I'm making it clear that it's about, you know, the attitudes around money that I think are hurting us. It's not money that, you know, that's the problem.
What other anxieties are you seeing, right? We spoke about financial stress. It's 2024, right? Are you seeing a lot of tech-related phone addiction, things like that? And what starts first? Is it something, you know, is it ADHD and then that's causing financial stress, phone addiction, things like that? Or is it sometimes the phone, the money, and then that is what causes the anxiety, lack of focus? Is it a chicken and egg thing?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I'm going to say it probably depends, you know, on the person, kind of like what comes first. Or, you know, when we see people, a lot of times we'll see diagnoses that are comorbid that go together. You know, anxiety and depression often travel together. So we try to figure out like what's primary. You know, if this was not there, the other thing still would be. You know, we try to parse that out. It really, really depends on the person. You mentioned phones, which is, you know, technology, social media really is a huge piece of this, of course. There's a new book out, actually, that I just got. It was just released by a psychologist by the name of Jonathan Haidt. It's called The Anxious Generation. And he really makes, from what I've read so far, I'm only halfway through, but he makes—
Is that a recommendation?
Yeah, it is a book recommendation. Look at that. he makes a very strong case for technology, and in particular social media, as really kind of destroying our kids, basically. That really is the source. And it makes sense because it definitely plays a role in attention issues. And for sure, it plays, the social comparison plays a huge role in anxiety and depression.
3 or 4 weeks ago, I deleted from my phone. I didn't deactivate the account. Mm-hmm. I deleted Twitter, Instagram. I didn't have TikTok, Threads, which is like a Facebook, Twitter, maybe one other. So I didn't feel any different. But like 3 or 4 mm-hmm. weeks in, I'm peppier, I'm jumping out of bed quicker. I'm like trying to think why. You know, I started taking my blood pressure medication in the morning and not at night. And then it dawned on me that I'm not getting lost in these mm-hmm. in these threads of tweets and yeah. messages and the dopamine hit. And I think there is something to be said about that. It's not like I've cut myself off completely.
Yes, exactly. And I was just going to say, I actually very much like that technique And I do tell that to people. You don't have to deactivate your account. Like, you're allowed to be a person in the, you know, online social world. That's understandable. But just taking the app off your phone is a great step because it means you still have access. You know, if all of a sudden you have this burning need, you know, to just see where your, you know, I don't know, brother-in-law is taking his next vacation and you have to go on Facebook, you could do it. Mm-hmm. But it's one step harder. It's not as easy. It's not as, I mean, that's the point of the apps, right? They make the experience more pleasant, easier to use. It just makes it a little bit harder to get so sucked in. So the, you know, it's still available to you. You're still a part of things in that way, but it just prevents you from getting like as sucked in as we normally do.
Is this the trajectory that cigarettes had? Right. In the beginning, doctors were recommending cigarettes and then it became the worst thing ever. Social media and its effect on people, teenagers, kids. Do you see it heading in that direction? Because in 2009, no one was talking about the dangers of social media. It was a shiny car. Get in. You know, we're going to the movies. Now it's, oh, maybe someone who's under 15 shouldn't have an account. Not even for the things that are on there, but just because of the effect it has on the mind.
Yeah. It's almost like you read this book. That's like the total thesis of this
book.
It is. Yeah, I do think it's like that. And I'll say, I think technology, social media, and money, I would put all of those into the same category of they are very, very powerful. So anything that has a tremendous power to create and to produce good things and to lead to good things also has an equal but opposite potential to be destructive. And I think that's true of all of these things. You know, I mean, technology, there's no question we are better off because of technology, right? Like there's, you know, been scientific findings and just, you know, on the smallest level, I get lost way less frequently since I have Waze, right? So like they're great. All these things are obviously great, but we also see, and we're starting to see more and more that there's the potential for it to be too much and for it to start to have negative effects. And for sure, the same is true of money. Like I said before, you know, money's great. I'm not anti-money. I think money can do wonderful things. You could do wonderful things with money, but there definitely is a tipping point where our attitude can shift and then it starts to really impact us in a negative way.
Coming back to the kids, how do you create healthy boundaries as it relates to technology? You know, devices, filtering, great, but do you look at it similarly to money, having those conversations with them instead of just saying, here are the rules in the family, this is what you have to abide by?
So some rules I think are just helpful, you know, and I'll just start by saying I'm guilty of doing all the wrong things, of course, obviously, because I am a person and we all do this, right? But, you know, there's like the basics that I think most of us have probably heard a million times, you know, have a filter, check on your kids and be aware of what they're doing. Don't let them sleep with their phone in their room, you know, right next to their bed. Like all those things are definitely good. But we also know that, you know, do as I say, not as I do, does not really work. And our kids really watch what we do. And I think this is true of technology. And I think it's true of money. We have to first sort of ask ourselves, where am I? And what are they seeing? And we'll go with technology. You know, am I addicted to my phone more than really I should be? And
yes,
if so, right. And if so, why? Right. Like what? And again, this entire thing I'm saying now could apply to money also. Am I too wrapped up in finances and, you know, spending money on things that maybe I wish I wasn't? Sure. So why is that? You know, what need is this filling for me? Is there a way for me to fill that in a different way? You know, for a lot of people, the phone is distraction. If I'm using it as a distraction, what am I distracting myself from? You know, asking ourselves those questions and then it just trickles down. I think if you set the tone in your house, again, technology, money, all these things, if you set a tone in your house, your kids pick up on it. They see it.
Good idea or bad idea? Having a communal section in the hallway of your upstairs for everyone to put their device in half hour, hour before they go to bed and then collect it in the morning.
I really like that idea. I think it's great. I haven't done it, but it's been on my mind as well. I think it's really, really smart. And I think it's hard to do. You know, I used to have this idea, okay, when we get home, we're all just going to immediately go plug our phones in somewhere and no one's going to look at them again until the end of the night. That is like enormously unrealistic. And, you know, we totally don't do that at all. What I will say we've done in our family is we really don't bring our phones to the dinner table. We eat dinner together, thank God, most of the time. And we really don't bring our phones. And, you know, that hour, or even honestly, if it's 25 minutes, like it's not like we always have such a formal long dinner. It could be quick. But that time spent together, I think, really does feel qualitatively different than when our phones are out.
Don't you find your best ideas come to you when you're not with your phone? You're not preoccupied. It could be driving. It could be just taking a walk. I have my phone. Sometimes my phone doesn't even make it to the charger next to the bed. you know, I don't even have strength because, and I'll just fall to the yep. wayside, wake up with like 22% battery. So there is certainly there. A quick break from this week's episode. I want to tell you about something cool. Okay. You all know about the Donors Fund. If not, I've spoken about it on previous episodes. I'm throwing the script away. I want to tell you about this. In my tefillin bag, my talis bag, I have $1 checks, $2 checks, and they come pre-printed. It is so cool. No longer do I give out cash. I give out these checks in shul. If someone comes in, they get a check. And at the end of the year, that is a tax deduction. Anyone who was giving away money on Purim had to give away cash dollars, and they weren't getting any tax deduction from that. So if you went to the bank and you thought it was cool filling out, oh, I want 10 ones, 35s, 40 20s, you're giving away money, but you're not giving it through your unique checkbook. It's kind of cool. It comes in the mail. There is so much the Donors Fund does. So that's just one piece. They have a lot. They have a mobile app. You can allocate money, put money in. You get an instant tax deduction, and then you can start giving the money away as you please. I don't want to give too much away, but the app is sleek. There's a website. You can invest money. They have a lot going for them. And the best part is it's free. So I love when someone sends me a message, hey, what's your unique link? I'm like, I got you. thedonorsfund.org/koshermoney. Click the link. The link is in the show notes. Fill it out. It is free. They have a massive customer satisfaction rate that is through the roof, and for good reason. They care. Okay, so fill it out. Get your free checkbooks. You can search up charities there. You can give without the checks. You can just instantly send the money out. You could put the money in there and then decide months later where you want to allocate it to and get the instant tax deduction. I love it because I'm speaking from my heart, right? Not everything has to be a script, and that's what we do here on Kosher Money. So thedonorsfund.org/koshermoney, link in the show notes. And now back to this week's episode. There is a lot in this article. What have we not covered so far? We spoke about the affecting the mental health, the social comparisons, the addiction of consumption, but deciding how and where to spend. There's a lot here. What haven't we covered maybe in this article or just what you're seeing out there?
So this is sort of like the, you know, other piece that I think we maybe don't pay enough attention to. I think that we just kind of assume we need what we need. We let society sort of like dictate to us what I need. You know, if everyone goes on vacation in January, I need to go on vacation in January. If everybody wears this type of outfit, I need to wear that type of outfit. Everyone's making this type of simcha, I need to also. And I think that we are not sometimes taking enough ownership of those choices. Of course, we take a lot from social comparison, and our community has a tremendous impact on the way we think and behave. But we also have a real ability to tell ourselves and teach ourselves what we want to value. So it's not just about what things do I value. You know, I value looking nice, so I buy myself clothing. I value a nice Shabbos meal, so I, you know, buy wine and meat or whatever. We also should be thinking about what do I want to value. So right now, I value looking a certain way, let's say. Is that what I want to value? Let's think about how much money I spend on that. Is that the amount that I want to be spending on that? And if we change our behavior, we can actually change our value system. So we think it goes in only one direction, that, you know, I think this is important, so therefore I spend that way. But it actually can go the other way, where if you change your spending, you will actually change the things that you think are important.
Interesting.
You know, an example that I think it's in the article, but an example that I often give is, you know, if you want to be a more charitable person, the way to do that is to start giving money. You know, if you say, I will give money when I feel more charitable, you're not going to spontaneously wake up and feel charitable. But what you do is you just start giving away money, and then you see yourself acting in a charitable way. It's like your brain's over here kind of like watching you, and you see yourself acting charitable and you say, huh, look at that. I guess I'm pretty charitable. And now I feel like a charitable person. So now I'm more likely to give the next time someone comes asking, right? So we actually, our behaviors sometimes have to come first, and they change the way we see ourselves. If I start spending differently, I will start to feel differently about spending. When I spend a lot of money on clothing, it makes me care more about clothing. It's not just that I care about clothing, so therefore I bought it. When I spend a lot of time and money on clothing, cars, whatever it is, I see myself doing that and I say, whoa, cars must be really important. Really? Why? What makes you think it's so important to drive a nice car? Well, look, I just, you know, spend all this money on it. It must be important. If I start spending my money in other places, I can actually change my own value system.
That's interesting, because growing up, they teach you shelo lishma will lead to lishma. Doing things not for the sake of it will lead to you doing for the sake of it. Just exposing yourself to the action takes up more of your time doing that thing, and then it leads you to think it's important.
And I'll also say, you know, we see that a lot, like in Judaism, there's a lot, you know, you're supposed to be happy on Yom Tov. So like, how do you make yourself happy? Well, you should do all of these things. And when you do them, it's going to impact the way you feel, and you'll probably feel happy. You're supposed to, you know, be sad on Tisha B'Av. How do you make yourself sad? Well, sit in a low chair, you know, et cetera, all those things. And we know that by changing your behavior, you change the way you feel. So don't wait until you feel differently about money to act differently about money. If you want to change how you feel about money, start acting the way you want to feel, and your thoughts and emotions will follow.
You bring up Judaism and the money we spend on the holidays. That's where we sort of get mixed signals, right? You're told to spend more on the beautification of the mitzvos and the Jewish commandments and buying nice clothing and investing into the religiousness of the holiday. But then the holiday ends and it's supposed to be like a switch. Like, okay, but don't spend too much on yourself. Go minimalistic on your next purchase. Is that somewhat of a struggle when you look at it from the outside?
Yeah, and I think also we should be honest with ourselves. So, you know, you should spend money to get ready for Yom Tov and feel good about Yom Tov. You should buy, you know, let's say a nice new outfit. When you're buying the nice new outfit, how much of it is so that you appreciate Yom Tov, like for the sake of Yom Tov, and how much is not? Like, let's sort of just be honest about with ourselves. And one thing I think is maybe an interesting thing to ask ourselves is, if nobody saw this purchase, what would I do? Like, if I wasn't going to see anyone on Yom Tov, if I was spending it on a deserted island, would I buy the nice outfit because it makes me feel good and it makes me, you know, celebrate Yom Tov in a nicer way or not? You know, like, if no one else saw my etrog, would I buy the nicest etrog? Yeah, I hope so. And then, you know, you should. That's really, really nice. But we should sort of like watch ourselves. How much of this is really kind of like Lekavod Shabbos and Yom Tov, and how much of it is really not?
Let's switch gears as we wrap up. So you're a therapist. People listening, they're 18, 19, 16, 22. They want to get into the field of therapy. Can someone in the 2020s make a nice living being a therapist?
I think so. I think I do okay. This is what I will say, is that most of the therapists that I know do a lot of things, myself included. I work primarily at Yeshiva University, but I also have a private practice on the side. There were times where I also taught a little bit on the side. So, and I think that that's sort of typical of my colleagues, is that a lot of us have our hands in a lot of different things. Part of it is because that is a way to maximize, you know, how much you can earn. Mostly, thank God, I will say for myself, mostly that's because I like doing all the things that I'm doing. I really like what I do, and I like to do a lot of different things, and I wouldn't want to give any of them up. But I would say to someone who is going to think about going into that field that that is the likely trajectory. It's not, you know, it's not a 9-to-5. It's not maybe nothing is a 9-to-5 anymore, but it's not I show up at an office and I clock in and I clock out and that's it. People are kind of like busy. There's, I'm going to say a hustle, but it's a happy hustle. I like what I do.
Would you like to see people who have never gone to therapy, if they feel like they need it, would you want to see them do one session? Because people, when they think of it as like a lifelong commitment. When, you know, 2 weeks ago, I reached out to a therapist and I said, I just want to have one session. I just want to talk something through with you. And it was great. And then he reached back out to me a week later. He's like, do you want to do another session? I said, no, maybe in the future, but I got something really good out of it. And he even asked me, he said before, like, what do you want to get out of this? Do you want to do most of the talking, or do you want to share a little bit and then hear from me my ideas, which I liked very much. And I get hit from this from people. They say, you always ask questions, or you ask questions in which you sort of lean the person into one answer, right? So I guess my question to you is therapy a lifelong commitment, or can it be done one time?
I'm going to say that most people, as far as I can tell, most people do not go to therapy lifelong. There are some people who do, that just like really like it and benefit from it, or maybe need it. And it really is, you know, lifelong for them. But that's not most, because it's often expensive and people don't have a lot of time. And that's mostly not what people are looking for. So it's not what most people do. When people ask me, very often people ask me, you know, okay, how long can I expect this to take? And obviously it's a ridiculous question, because it totally depends, as you said, on what you want to accomplish. Most people go for much more short-term therapy than that. And then there's, you know, the extremes on either end. There are people that I have seen for many years, and they probably plan to be in therapy for many more years to come. And then there are a lot of people that I've seen, you know, 1, 2, 3 times, and that's it.
those people that you've seen for many years, do most of them make real progress, or are they just, you know, staying in a range just because they can't slip?
Again, I'm sorry if this is like a cop out of an answer, but it's the truth. There's really a range. Some people come to therapy, and this is fewer people because of the time and money issue. But some people come to therapy because they like being in therapy. They like having a place every week to go and, you know, talk about what they want to talk about. And it's not someone that's in their lives in any other capacity. And they like doing that. And if they like doing that and they could afford to do that and they have time, they could do that forever. That's not most people. Most people come with an issue that they want to work on. And thank God we do typically see, you know, very positive changes.
Most good therapists don't take insurance, right?
I don't like to say that because
you didn't say it. I said it.
I know. I'm going to say, yeah, it's true that a lot of therapists do not take insurance, myself included, if I'm going to be honest. But I don't like to say it because I don't want to disparage the ones who do. If someone takes insurance, do not assume that they are a bad therapist. Okay. They might not be a bad therapist. A lot of people take insurance because it's a way to quickly fill up a practice. If you want to see 30, 40 patients a week, taking insurance is a great way to get that done quickly. Mm-hmm. People, put myself in this category, who don't take insurance, often it's not their primary thing. So, you know, they're, like I said, I'm primarily working at a counseling center, my private practice on the side. I don't take insurance.
Noted. What didn't we cover as it relates to money, mental health, therapy that you feel, you know, with an audience, hopefully tens of thousands of people listening? Any closing remarks, thoughts, things we didn't cover?
So this is one thing that I thought you were going to ask me, and I think that you didn't, is about attitudes toward money and how they have shifted over time.
Okay.
I think a lot about that. When I think about my grandparents and how they approached money, I think they thought about what money could do for them. They all started with none. You know, either they came to this country, you know, literally with nothing, but they all started for various reasons with just, you know, I think as many of our grandparents did, with nothing. And thank God we're able to become successful. And they used their money to do good things for them. So money bought them maybe time with their family. Money definitely bought them opportunity. They were able to give their children and grandchildren educational opportunities. But it was really about like, what can I do with this? How can I contribute? How can I help the next generation? And I think we have shifted a lot into a mentality of what money can buy as opposed to what it can do. And it's maybe a nuance, you know, of a distinction. I think it's important because if we start thinking about what money can do and what we want to be able to do with our money, often we'll find money's not the only way to do it. So, you know, if I want to be able to contribute to my community in a meaningful way, money is one great way to do that. But there's also other ways that I could do that. So it's just much less limiting. If I want to think about, you know, money is something that can buy me things, well, the only way to get those things is money. So if I want nice things, money is really basically the only way to get me there. If I want to have meaningful experiences, money can help, but it's not the only way.
That's cool. Yeah. Because sometimes you'll have a wealthy person says, how much of a check do I need to write to make this problem go away? And it's like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Right.
That's not the only answer. And it's also maybe not always the best answer.
Right. And we should be honest. I think that money makes a lot of things easier. There are problems that can be fixed with money if you have enough money. There's no question. I mean, we see mental health outcomes are better on the whole for people who have money because they can afford access to better care. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just true. And, you know, we're not going to pretend that it isn't. But there's a limit to that. And money doesn't fix all things. And I'm going to say that money actually doesn't fix the most important things.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Alper.
Thank you for having me.
We'll put your email address in the show notes. We'll put a link to the article, the book recommendation, and we really appreciate you making the trek from Oceanside.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
And there you have it. Another episode of Kosher Money is in the books. We have a brand new studio. I'm very excited about it. And more people are discovering Kosher Money and living L'chaim in general. So if you are one of the few and you're just realizing that Living L'chaim exists, we have so many shows. We have Inspiration for the Nation. We have That's an Issue, a mental health show. We now have Podcast Therapy with Dr. Z. Go to livinglachaim.com. You can check out all the shows. Those were just some of them. We got more in the books. And we also have sponsorship opportunities. So if you have a business, a nonprofit, you have something that needs to be seen, Living L'chaim, I would say, is one of the best kept secrets. We don't have a marketing team, right? People who advertise on these shows are people that listen and realize, hey, I can literally reach on any given week tens of thousands of people at, I don't know, $1,000, $2,000. that is highly impactful, and you reach people at a time in which they have the ability, right? They have the ability during the 6 days of the week to act on your sponsorship. So if you have a message that you want to get out there, livinglechaim.com, reach out to us, hi@livinglechaim.com. Whatever you want, we are here for you. Oh, and you don't have a business? You can actually donate and inspire millions with a tax-deductible donation to Living L'Chaim. It's a generous donation or a non-generous. Every dollar is generous. It enables us at Living L'Chaim to share uplifting messages, globally enriching lives and fostering positive change worldwide. So if you have the ability to donate, livinglechaim.com/donate. You can even donate to Living L'Chaim and Kol Chabad via the Donors Fund while wearing your Twillery shirt. Thank you to our friends at livingsmarterjewish.org. They have now coached over 3,000 families, couples, people that need help budgeting. They are there for you. They have financial curriculums if you want to get it into your school. Don't sleep on this. We're training the next generation to be fiscally responsible, but also live life healthy. Right? We're not telling everyone to not spend money, but there are ways to actually have an amazing life financially. What else? What am I missing? Oh, right. If you are watching this on YouTube, I have a message for you. You are going to be entered for the chance to win an amazing book from my friend, Rabbi Daniel Lapin. Okay? All you need to do is punch in the word helpful in a sentence. You can write the word, this episode was very helpful. I found this conversation to be helpful. You can do any form of the word help, and you will be entered in for the chance to win an amazing book, Thou Shall Prosper, from Rabbi Daniel Lapin. An amazing guy. We've actually done two episodes with him. Stay tuned, more in the works. We're actually going to Dave Ramsey's studio another time. So, if you have a question, email us your question for Dave Ramsey, hi@livinglechaim.com, and we cannot thank you enough. Okay, I'm tired. Talking is tedious. So without further ado, go to the next podcast, turn off the radio, go to sleep. Gosh, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. Stop it. Goodbye.
Living L'Chaim.